I'll expand this broadly just beyond the Day of Atonement itself, but that is a good introductory beginning, since we will have this on our minds here pretty quickly, and we will become aware of the experience we go through on this commanded fast day. One thing I've always wondered about, sometimes interesting to look it up to try to get the origin of the source of the words, but I've always wondered why they call it fast day, a fast day. It's always been a slow day to me. But that's a terminology that's come into being, and so when we refer to fasting, that is refraining from food and or drink during a given period of time, we call it a fast. Well, there is more than one type of a fast. There are fasts for various purposes and reasons. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on reasons other than biblical reasons, except to point out that, as I mentioned a week or so ago, all, let's say, knowledgeable people who are familiar with the human body and human system and who are not heavily involved in the whole drug syndrome recognize the need to fast occasionally for health reasons, simply because a human body has a proclivity of becoming toxic, probably due to faulty diet or lack of exercise and or both, and possibly a lot of the harmful ingredients, additives of one type or another that are put into the bloodstream, that is put into the food, which in turn end up eventually in the bloodstream. It is good occasionally to fast to cleanse the system. Length of time depending on what a person's need would be. In this particular case, however, I want to confine the subject of fasting specifically to what the Bible itself instructs in a general sense on the subject. I can tell you what fasting is not. And that's found here in Matthew, the 6th chapter, beginning here in verse number 16. Jesus said, "Moreover, when ye fast, be not as the hypocrites, of a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces, that they may appear unto men to fast. Verily I say unto you, they have their reward. But thou, when thou fastest," so Jesus is showing that occasionally Christians should fast, "when thou fastest, anoint thy head and wash thy face, that thou appear not unto men to fast, but unto thy Father which is in secret, and thy Father which seeth in secret shall reward thee openly." So one thing it is not a display of what one is suffering in order to impress other human beings. Fasting should be done specifically because of one's relationship with God. Now, I'm going to just confine this to three or four major broad areas and give you a number of texts to show in general why fasting was done. Remember, when we're talking about fasting, we are talking about refraining from food and drink. Generally, a health fast includes drinking some type of a liquid, but a spiritual fast generally includes a total abstinence from both food and water for a given period of time. A health fast may extend over a week or longer. In fact, if you're familiar at all with what's been going on over in Ireland, you've been hearing about, and this isn't only in Ireland, it's in other places now, you've been hearing about these hunger strikes. And these prisoners refuse to eat, and they try to feed them intravenously. They give them liquids. And some of those men over in those prisons in Ireland have gone right in the vicinity of 60 days without food before dying, even though they were given liquids of one type or another during that time period. So it does show the body can go a considerable period of time without food, but our recommendation has always been that if anyone is going to go on an extended fast of any kind, then they should certainly get sound advice from somebody who is knowledgeable in that field, and preferably a doctor who may be aware of the values of fasting. Other than that, probably the average person would be wise to confine the length of his fast, probably no more than 3 days if he's going to go on a total fast without food or water. And I wouldn't necessarily advise that for a person who's older or who's doing hard physical labor. Any number of young people in the past that I know personally have fasted 3 days and three nights without food and water, and in some cases were doing physical work while they were doing it. But generally, for a spiritual fast, our recommendation in times past has been 24 hours without food or water. And that would certainly be a safe margin and would not likely to cause any physical difficulty with anyone. And I think just based on what we see by the Day of Atonement command, that is from even to even, then I think that is indicative of probably what a spiritual fast normally would be. Some people may want to go longer, but I think based on the Bible, certainly 24 hours would be about right. Now what, first of all, what were the reasons and purposes that people fasted in the Bible? I'm going to put this under a broad heading and give you a number of texts to demonstrate it. The first reason was for public calamity or threatened public calamity. In other words, those events which were transpiring within the community, in this case, the nation of Israel, which was in the nature of a calamity and affected everybody. It isn't limited to that by all means, because we'll see there are personal reasons also. But first and foremost, there are a number of examples in the Bible showing that fasting was done in the case of national calamity or threatened national calamity. Let's notice some texts that illustrate the point. First of all, in 1 Samuel, going back to the book of Samuel, 1 Samuel 31 and 13. This is the incident, remember, when Saul and his sons were slain in battle, and Israel was defeated in the battlefield. Now, this was a national calamity. Not only was the army of Israel defeated and driven from the field, but the national leadership was destroyed. And, you know, in spite of all of the faults that Saul had in his relationship with David, you know, we read in the Bible confines itself essentially to one major area, and that is Saul's spiritual deficiencies in his relationship with David and where he failed to fulfill God's will. But I think we could safely say that for the average person living within the nation of Israel, all of the things that Saul had done were not directly affecting them. That is, in any personal way. You'll find out later on, I'm not going to turn to the text to read it today, but you will find examples stated in the Bible where David praises Saul for all of the good things and all of the fine things that the ladies and the men of Israel enjoyed under Saul's reign. What I'm pointing out is that in spite of Saul's sins and all of the things that he had been guilty of in the sight of God, his defeat was a national calamity for many, many of the citizens, because an entire way of life and civilization coming to an end was at stake. It's much like we could give a modern day comparison, you know. Anybody who's knowledgeable with what's going on in world affairs, and certainly with what has been going on in the United States for any number of years, knows that no politician is going to solve the problem. But if I had to take a choice between the two, I'd take the least of the evils, wouldn't you? Now, would it not have been a national calamity to have seen the president successfully assassinated, you know, toward the early part of the year? That would have been a terrible thing. It would have been a national calamity. In spite of the fact that it is unlikely that he's ever going to really be able to solve the general problem of what's going on in the world with respect to economics, culture, you know, and you name it. But it still would have been a national calamity and a loss had that happened. So let's put ourselves in the position then of the average person in Saul's day. And we read here in 1 Samuel 31, verse number 6, "So Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and all his men, that same day together." Now, it didn't mean that every citizen that was out in the battlefield died. It simply meant that the coterie that Saul surrounded himself with, his personal bodyguard, his aides, his close men, they stayed there and fought to the death. And Saul and his sons, and really what it's really saying is that the leadership of Israel was cleaned out in one fell swoop. Now, how was the reaction? How did the people react? Well, here's one example. Verse number 11, when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard of that which the Philistines had done to Saul, and I'm not reading all of what happened, you know, they cut their heads off, as I recall, and I think that was the case, and they hung their bodies up in a certain place, you know, publicly humiliated the bodies of Saul and so forth. And so when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard of that which the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall in Bethshan and came to Jabesh and burnt them there. And they took their bones and buried them under a tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. That was a pretty long fast. It was a national calamity. So here's a Bible example of when fasting was done. Now you go right over to the next chapter in 2 Samuel chapter 1, and we see David's reaction when he heard of Saul's death. In spite of all of the evil that Saul had done to David, David recognized it as a national calamity. In other words, he didn't view it just as a personal feud between him and Saul. He saw it for what it really was in its proper perspective. A terrible blow to the whole nation of Israel. Then David took hold, this is verse 11, 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 11, then David took hold on his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him, and they mourned and wept and fasted until even. For Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. So again, you see, the Bible demonstrates that fasting certainly is a thing to do in a time of national calamity, public calamity, or threatened calamity. 2 Samuel 3, verse 35. Here's another example a little bit later on down the line. I won't go into all the background of this, except briefly to explain here that Joab performed a treacherous act and he wanted to get rid of the competitors, anybody who may have been one of his competitors, and in this case it was the other general who represented Saul's son by the name of Abner, and he slew him surreptitiously, as it says here, when a man wasn't looking, he smote him under the fifth rib. In other words, he assassinated him. Now, this was a terrible thing. And David realized what a terrible act this was. Treacherous, terrible act. And it was a national calamity. And so what was David's reaction here? When the people came to cause David to eat meat while it was yet day, because now, see, here was David's enemy removed. Remember, the son of Saul, who was competing against David for the control and the throne of the nation of Israel. Now here was the primary military leader of the opposite side slain. You'd certainly think, boy, this was a wonderful thing. Now we can rejoice. And David would have said, it's all mine. Know what was David's reaction? The people came to eat meat while it was yet day. David swore, saying, so do God to me and more also, if I taste bread or aught else till the sun be down. And all the people took notice of it, and it pleased them. In other words, David fasted over Abner's death. It was a tragic thing, and it was a treacherous thing that Joab had done, and it should never have been done. But he showed by that his respect for God and for his fellow man. Here's another example from the book of Ezra. In this particular case, it is referring to a threatened calamity. So in the book of Ezra, the 8th chapter, I'll simply give you a little bit of the background and then go to the text here. You'll recall this was a time when Ezra, the ready scribe, was carrying out a responsibility when the Jewish people were going back, that is, a certain portion of them were going back from the Babylonian captivity. And the king was favorable, that is, the Persian king was favorable and gave them the permission and the right to do so. But notice what Ezra did here in Ezra, the 8th chapter, beginning here in verse number 21. Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might afflict ourselves before our God, to seek of him a right way for us and for our little ones and for all our substance. For I was ashamed to require of the king a band of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy in the way, Because we had spoken unto the king, saying, The hand of our God is upon all them for good that seek him, but his power and his wrath is against them that forsake him. So we fasted and besought our God for this, and he was entreated of us. In other words, it was a long journey they were going to take from Babylon through the wilderness. And under normal conditions, you know, there were brigands, bands of robbers, Arabic tribes of one type or another in there. And it was a threatened situation because they could have been overrun by a large band of robbers or pirates or thieves, kidnappers, slave traders. And so they fasted and they prayed for God to protect them because he did not want to ask the king for soldiers and military support to make that trip. And he said, God was entreated of us. So again, it demonstrates in the case of calamity or threatened calamity, fasting is certainly the thing to do. Here in the book of Esther, let's notice another example here. This is the fourth chapter. Again, a little bit of the background. You recall it was the whole plot at this time by Haman, the Agagite, to rid the land of the Jews. And so Mordecai came to the queen, in this case Esther, and asked her to intercede in behalf of the king. And you will recall there was a law in Persia. That is, if you appeared before the king and demanded or required an audience by the king and you did not ask him to call you, when you came in that hall, you did it at the risk of your life, because if he chose to hold out the scepter, then your request was granted and you could come and talk to him. But if he chose not to do it, it was an automatic death sentence. You died for that presumptuousness, as they viewed it. So what happened? Well, she hadn't seen the king in 30 days, and so she put her life on the line. And she appeared before the king, and you remember the story. When he saw her coming, he held out the scepter, and she received her request. But notice what she said first. Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer. Mordecai had sent a message to her, and then this was her answer. This was in Esther 4, verse 16. Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat nor drink 3 days, night or day. This was a total fast for 3 days and three nights, because this was a threatened public calamity. This could have meant the lives of many people. I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And so will I go in unto the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. She laid her life on the line for the sake of those people. But you see, they fasted 3 days and three nights. So again, it demonstrates that public calamity or threatened calamity is certainly one of the major reasons that fasting was done in the Bible. If any of you are familiar at all with history, you are aware that there have been presidents in times past who have asked our people to fast in times of national calamity. And it is certainly a biblical thing. Here in the book of Joel is one other example. Joel, the first chapter and verse number 14, you know, if you're familiar with the background, it's telling about all of the destruction that has occurred. Destruction of vineyards, national calamity, in other words, what is describing here. Joel, the first chapter. The vine is dried up, the fig tree languishes, pomegranate, palm also, etc. They're all withered. And it just shows there's a national calamity. What are they told to do here? Verse 14 of Joel. Sanctify ye a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the elders and all the inhabitants of the land into the house of the Lord your God, and cry unto the Lord. So here was a national fast sanctified, again in the case of calamity. So that is one major reason that fasting was done, and we've already seen in some cases it went up to 7 days, whether it was total or partial, the Bible doesn't reveal. But we certainly see in one instance a total fast for 3 days and three nights. So it does demonstrate what does take place in times of national calamity or threatened calamity. Now that's in the public sense. Now let's take it on down to the personal sense. That is to say, what about fasting as far as you are concerned as an individual? What are the reasons and purposes for it? Well, we have some Bible examples that illustrate that too. Let us go first of all to 2 Samuel chapter 12. 2 Samuel chapter 12. And the background here is the incident concerning David and Bathsheba, the murder of Uriah, and David taking Bathsheba to wife, and her now giving child to an illegitimate son. Illegitimate, you see, in the sense that she belonged to another man. She was the wife of Uriah the Hittite. So what happened? 2 Samuel 12, verse 15, and Nathan departed unto his house, that is, the prophet Nathan departed unto his house after warning David and telling him what was going to happen. And what happened? The Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bare unto David, and it was very sick. Now here's a personal, very, very emotional problem and affliction here in David's private personal life. David therefore besought God for the child, and David fasted and went in and lay all night upon the earth. I want you to notice here, it must have gone a considerable period of time, because we read here in verse 17, the elders of his house arose and went to him to raise him up from the earth, but he would not. Neither did he eat bread with him, and it came to pass on the seventh day that the child died. So the indication is here, David fasted 7 days. Well, we know the rest of the story. They didn't want to tell him because, you know, they just felt it was such a tragic thing that would affect him if they did tell him. Finally, they were whispering, and he could perceive what was going on. And they said, he asked them, and they told him he was dead. Now notice, verse 20, then David arose from the earth and washed and anointed himself and changed his apparel and came into the house of the Lord and worshipped. Then he came to his own house, and when he required, they set bread before him, and he did eat. Now, they were just dumbfounded. Why in the world would he react this way? You're now with a child at the time of death. Now he's eating. And then notice the answer here. He said, while the child was yet alive, I fasted and wept. For I said, who can tell whether God will be gracious to me and that the child may live? But now he's dead. Wherefore should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me. So David recognized at this point the purpose of the fast was over. He was fasting for a specific purpose. Why was he fasting? He was fasting with the hopes that God would change his mind. But God would not change his mind in this instance. This was too serious of a matter. And I mean, this involved a national example. And God recognized that for the good of all involved, his decision concerning the life of this child was the wisest thing, and it would not be revoked. But from David's viewpoint, you see, he tried because he knew that God was a very merciful God, and, you know, there are times when he does change his mind. But it does show that here was a personal, private problem and affliction involving the little child and involving David, and personally he fasted because it certainly was worth it, and he knew it. Here's another example in Psalm 35. This is just a brief statement here, but it does show you see, again, when David was fasting. He's talking here about how when he tried to do good, he got rewarded back evil. He said, they rewarded me evil for good. This is in Psalm 35 and verse number 12. To my personal bereavement is a better way to translate this. They rewarded me evil for good, to my personal bereavement. But as for me, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. I humbled my soul with fasting, and my prayer returned unto my own bosom. So again, when was the time for David to fast? It says here when they were sick. Now these people obviously didn't appreciate it. They didn't have any sense of gratitude. Their hearts, no doubt, were not right. But David certainly was. And at their sickness and at their time, he fasted for them, which again indicates a time to be fasting. Here in the book of Daniel, we see another example of fasting, Daniel 6. And in this case, it is a pagan king that's doing it, but it does show you that even pagan kings recognize the need at a time of a personal problem, at a time of an affliction, at a time when they're greatly concerned about something, fasting is a proper thing to do. So this is the incident, you remember, of Daniel in the lion's den. And the king was very fond of Daniel, and Daniel had proven to be a very valuable man, and yet through subterfuge, these connivers had gotten the king to sign this petition. And if you remember at all, the laws of the Medes and the Persians, remember, cannot be revoked. So once the king made the mistake of signing it, it could not be revoked, and Daniel was consigned to the lion's den. Now the king was very distressed about this, but legally there was nothing he could do about it. Sometimes you wonder how some of these laws ever developed and how they ever came into being, but that's the way the cookie crumbles, as the old saying is, and there isn't anything you can do about it. So what happened? The stone was placed upon the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that the purpose might not be changed concerning Daniel. This is Daniel 6, verse 17. Verse 18, then the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. He spent the whole night awake, worried and concerned over Daniel. And he spent the night fasting. You see, well, obviously, he didn't have his big banquet or luncheon that evening. And, you know, I don't know all that the rigmarole that kings go through, you know, and how many times during the course of a night somebody offers him a drink or comes in and fans him or whatever is involved in the whole thing, sits and plays music to him, you know, and he didn't have any of that. All of his amenities he passed up for the sake of Daniel. So you see, it does demonstrate that at a time of crises and at a time of great concern, then that's the time to fast. Now, one other example from the New Testament here doesn't give the circumstances behind it here, but it does demonstrate that it certainly is a proper thing to do at given times if there's a necessity. And this is in 1 Corinthians 7, verse number 5. Defraud ye not one another, except it be with consent for a time. In this case, it simply means they refrain from the normal marital relations. And it says here, the purpose, that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. So what is it saying here? It's saying here that there are probably times in a marriage when a husband and wife would set aside time to fast, and they could spend that time, as it says here, in fasting and prayer. So there may come a time when that is necessary. But it certainly does demonstrate here from the Bible that that is certainly permissible and the proper thing to do on given occasions. All right, now there's only one other broad category, and I'm using these as broad categories. Remember what I said, public calamity, things of a national import that affect the whole population and the entire people. Public calamity or threatened calamity of one type or another. Also, problems and afflictions, difficulties, sicknesses, trials. That's a time when a person should decide to fast. And then the last one here that the Bible demonstrates is the matter of ordinations. I can remember years ago in the ministry, whenever there was ever an ordination, there was always fasting that preceded it. Later years, that didn't happen to be the case. In fact, it almost got to the place in later years where they were flipping coins for who was going to be ordained. I'm not saying they did that, but it almost became that frivolous, I'll put it that way. In fact, I think that I heard of one case on a divorce and remarriage decision where nobody knew how to make the decision, so one of the leading ministers flipped a coin and they based it on the flip of a coin. Whether that incident actually happened or not, I don't know, but at least that's what I heard at one time. I would just say this, seeing the way things went, I wouldn't be too surprised if that happened. I'm not saying it did, but I wouldn't be too surprised if it did. But ordinations is another time when fasting should be done. Notice an example here in Acts the 13th chapter. Acts the 13th chapter, beginning here in verse 1. Now there were in the church that was at Antioch certain prophets and teachers. Names them here, Barnabas, Simeon that was called Niger or Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Maian, which had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul. In this case, this is the one who became the Apostle Paul. His name at this point is still Saul. As they ministered to the Lord and fasted. So here they were fasting. The Holy Spirit said, "Separate me, Barnabas and Saul, for the work whereunto I have called them." And when they had fasted and prayed, they laid their hands on them and they sent them away. Now, I'm not saying that this was an actual ordination. It was always assumed in the past that this was an ordination. It may have been simply setting aside these men who now have been commissioned to do a certain thing. That is really beside the point. What is important here in this case is that in the matter of a major spiritual decision that was being made, where a major thing was going to begin to take place with God's work, fasting was involved. Now the other incident is in Acts 14 chapter and verse number 23, where we read here again, Paul and his party were here. They had preached a gospel to that city beginning in verse 21, Acts 14 verse 21, and had taught many. They returned again to Lystra and to Iconium and Antioch, confirming the souls of the disciples and exhorting them to continue in the faith, and that we must through much tribulation enter into the kingdom of God. And when they had ordained them elders in every church and had prayed with fasting, they commended them to the Lord on whom they believed. So again, see, when they ordained these elders, fasting was involved. So it does show that fasting should certainly be done with respect to ordinations, and that would involve the ministry primarily. So those are the three broad areas the Bible demonstrates for the reason for one to fast. Now let us add another element to it, because the matter of just going through the physical fast is one thing, but what should be the person's attitude and frame of mind? In other words, what should accompany this fasting? Now remember, we're going to be coming up here on the Day of Atonement, the most solemn festival in the year, the one commanded fast day. So what is involved in fasting? All right, let's go back first of all to Deuteronomy, the 9th chapter. Deuteronomy, the 9th chapter. And I'll just give you a little bit of the background. You recall here, Moses is rehearsing Israel's rebellion when they were in the wilderness. He showed how that God had given him these two tables of stone, and on these two tables of stone were the Ten Commandments. And God himself had written these commandments on this stone. And we read here in verse 11, "It came to pass at the end of 40 days and 40 nights that the Lord gave me the two tables of stone, even the tables of the covenant." Then, remember, he came down from the mountain, and what had they done? Well, you know, you've all heard the saying, when the cat's away, the mice will play. And so that's what happened. They weren't very dedicated to the truth, that's for sure. And they really fouled up the detail, and Moses came down there and was very upset, angry. And you'll recall, the tables were broken. He said, I took the two tables and cast them out of my hands and break them before your eyes, and I fell down before the Lord. Verse 18 is at the first 40 days and 40 nights. I did neither eat bread nor drink water because all of your sins which you sinned in doing wickedly in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. So what was he doing? He was confessing their sins. So one of the main things that must go along with fasting is confession and humiliation and humbling of the self. In fact, that is one of the most effective things that is accomplished by fasting itself. It is the whole experience is a humiliating, humbling thing. And in this particular case here, you see, he says that he was falling before the Lord. He was down before the Lord because of their sins and doing wickedly and provoking, their very act had provoked him to anger. So, as he says here, he was certainly, what is involved here certainly was the acknowledgement on Moses' part for the people's failure to live up to it and confessing their sins, even though the people themselves didn't have enough sense to realize, I guess, what they had been doing. Now, here's one other example in 1 Samuel 7. Remember, Israel had gone through the period of the judges. And they had had seven major apostasies during that time period. And God had raised up judges to judge Israel and to keep them back on right track. Now we come to the days of Samuel. And again, things were in a very spiritual, they were in a spiritual decline. And the people were tormented and they were undecided, and they were suffering from afflictions and calamities in a national sense of one type or another, and they wanted to improve that condition. They wanted to get back with God, and they wanted to get back on the right track and get on their feet as a nation and as a people. And remember, it was during this time period that the ark had been captured and had not been there for a period of time. So we read here in 1 Samuel 7, verse 3, and Samuel spake unto all the house of Israel, saying, if you do return unto the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the strange gods and the Asheroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve him only, and he'll deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. So what did he say they had to do? They had to repent as a nation and as a people. They had to give up this idolatry and turn back to God. Then the children of Israel did put away Balaam and Ashtaroth and served the Lord only. And Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah. That's where the tabernacle was located for a number of years. And I will pray for you unto the Lord. And they gathered together at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord and fasted on that day. So here in this process of getting back right with God again, they were fasting. And they said, notice what they're doing. They're confessing their sins and their shortcomings. We have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the children of Israel in Mizpah. In other words, that's where the tabernacle was located, and that's where Samuel went to judge them and act as their judge. But it was at that location that they came there, confessed their sins before God, and fasted, and asked God to get them back on track again. So you see, that's one of the primary purposes of fasting. It is a matter of confession, of humiliation of the self, of humbling the self, and getting into the right frame of mind and right spirit and attitude with God. Nehemiah 9, verses 1 and 2. Here's another example. In this case, this was a national restoration, keeping of the Feast of Tabernacles. This was after they had returned from the Babylonian captivity. Here they were so absolutely ignorant of what the Bible even said, they didn't even realize the law of God commanded the Feast of Tabernacles. The dwelling in, or sitting in booths is just a better translation there. And all that was involved with the Feast of Tabernacles. So we read here, they kept the feast 7 days. This is in Nehemiah 8 in the last verse, 18. And on the eighth day was a solemn assembly according to the manner. Now, we pick it up in chapter 9. In the 24th day of this month, the children of Israel were assembled with fasting and with sackcloths and earth upon them. And the seed of Israel separated themselves from all strangers and stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. So what did this fasting, this involved repentance? This involved confession of their sins, humbling of the self, humiliation before God, acknowledging their faults. You know, it's like you've seen this little sign. I mean, it's always humorous, but there's probably more truth to it than meets the eye, you know. It'll say, you know, the trouble with most people is they will not admit their faults. We would admit ours if we had any. Well, you know, it is difficult for people to admit their faults. In fact, it is very difficult for people to admit their faults. You know, it might not be so hard for you to admit your faults to God privately in prayer, but how easy is it for you to admit your faults to everybody else? Seems like the most difficult person to admit your faults to is your husband and your wife, isn't it? And yet they're the ones that know your faults better than anybody else, don't they? So maybe that's why you feel you don't need to tell them. They already ought to know them. But I mean, to stand up publicly in front of the whole nation, and here's the leaders, you know, what do you think would happen in the United States if the president would get up and confess to God really what the national sins of America are? And alive, what do you think would happen to him in the press? And it is a difficult thing to do. So here they were doing it because they wanted to get themselves right with God. But here was fasting, here was confession of sins, even the confessing of the iniquities of their fathers. So we do have to realize that confession and humiliation and a humbling of the self go right along with fasting. Psalm 69, verse number 10. Here's another example, just a brief statement, but it certainly does show what went on during the time of fasting. Here we find, when I wept and chastened my soul with fasting, that was to my reproach. So what was going on here? Not only was he chastening his soul with fasting, he was weeping along with it. Now that's repentance. So it does demonstrate that, he says, I made sackcloth also my garment, and I became a proverb to them. Oh, I imagine they really laughed and thought that was funny. Here was this serious man going through all this rigmarole he went through, and they were laughing at it, and yet he said he was weeping and chastening his soul in order to get himself right with God again. Sometimes that's necessary for all of us to do that. Probably none of us do it enough. Now, there are a couple of texts here that really demonstrate the proper attitude that should be involved in fasting. One of the primary ones, and I would certainly consider it one of the most important texts in the whole Bible in the matter of what one's attitude should be in this thing of fasting. And this is in Isaiah 58, beginning here in verse number 3. You know, people always seem to want results, you know, out of fasting, but sometimes they don't even know their motivation is wrong. It's almost like the example Jesus gave, you know, in the New Testament, where this man, you know, these two men came to the temple to pray, one a publican and the other sinner, and the publican said, I fast twice in the week. But it was doing him no good. It was a ritual he was going through because it was expected of him on a regular basis. It was a part of the religion. It wasn't because the real desire and heart was there for him to make himself right with God. So what did Isaiah write? Verse 3, Isaiah 58, wherefore have we fasted, say they, and thou seest not? Almost reminds you, you know, I remember when I was growing up as a boy, we had a Catholic church in town, and I had some friends that were Catholics, although never really any close friends that were Catholics. Never really did. But I can remember this strange thing that they always did, and that is that they didn't eat meat on Friday. That was it. They ate fish instead. I guess I carried on over into the military, because I can remember every single Friday night I'd start walking to the mess hall, and I'd get about halfway there and turn around and go to the PX. I'd smell that fish emanating from that mess hall, and I didn't go any further. I went down and got a hamburger every Friday night at the PX. There's something about that military fish. If you've ever been in a military mess hall on a Friday night, you'll know what I mean. You'll never forget the smell. But see, they called not eating meat on Friday fasting. Well, it's whole, you know, there's any biblical substantiation for that fact. If you know the real origin of it, it comes from paganism to begin with. But anyway, it isn't doing them any good than anybody else. Except maybe, you know, some people eat too much meat and they need fish once in a while. Anyway, wherefore have we fasted, say they, and thou seest not? Wherefore have we afflicted our soul, and thou takest no knowledge? They want to know why they're not getting any results. So God tells them, behold, in the day of your fast you find pleasure and exact all your labors. They weren't really fasting. No, they were just going through a kind of a partial thing, and they did not really set that day aside for what? For confession, for humiliation, for humbling the self, for prayer, for weeping, for getting themselves right with God. They just went through a kind of a ritual because it was a kind of a physical thing they were required to do, but there wasn't any real motivation to get themselves right with God. Behold, you fast for strife and debate. In other words, to get your way, you know, to come out on top, to be number one, and to smite with the fist of wickedness. And then God says, you shall not fast as you do this day to make your voices to be heard on high. That's not going to get you any results. You don't do it that way. Is it such a fast that I've chosen? All right, here's the kind of fast he says he's chosen. A day for a man to afflict his soul. You know, you don't fast by refraining from one item of food and calling that a fast and eating everything else. A day for a man to afflict his soul. Is it to bow down the head as bulrush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this a fast and acceptable day unto the Lord? Is not this the fast that I've chosen? Here's the real purpose for it. To loose the bands of wickedness. You know, to get rid of wicked things out of your life. To undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke. In other words, you're going to get rid of these things that are holding you back and suppressing you. That's the real purpose of the fast. Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry? In other words, you begin to think about others and besides yourself all the time. In other words, people who are very self-centered, frankly, should spend more time fasting. Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house? When thou seest the naked, and that thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh? So you see, that's the real purpose of the fast. To get rid of the vanity, to get rid of the self, to get rid of the selfishness, to get rid of all the ego. Like, I almost laughed yesterday. A car was driving in front of me. I don't remember where this was now. But the first three numbers on the license plate were ego. I thought, ghastly, how did a man ever get a license plate like that? That's what human nature is, isn't it? It's nothing but full of ego. Well, fasting helps eradicate those things. Fasting helps get rid of self-centeredness. And fasting helps one to loosen the burdens and the things that are controlling him. That's a real benefit and the blessing of the fast. And then, here in Joel, the second chapter, and this, again, is a continuation of the same principle. This is what God says. You know, in this case, it's talking about a national calamity, but it shows what each individual is going to have to do about it to get himself right with God. Joel 2, verse 12. Therefore also now, saith the Lord, turn ye unto me with all your heart. Not just partly. It's not just going through a ritual. You do it because you mean it and you recognize and you see the value of it. Turn unto me, he says here, with all your heart and with fasting and with weeping and with mourning. What goes with it? Weeping and mourning. And rend your heart and not your garments. You know, they went through the physical thing back in those days. You know, they'd rip the garment of the physical sign. Then they'd throw dust on themselves as a symbol of humiliation, and that's how they showed how they were fat. It's kind of a dirty thing to do. It could be expensive if you had a nice fancy robe, wouldn't it? I mean, any of you imagine? You know, all of a sudden some calamity strikes and you all of a sudden you pull your jacket off and you start tearing it to shreds. Get kind of expensive after a while, you know, if you buy suits, wouldn't it? Well, that isn't even really going to do the purpose, because God says he doesn't want you to rend your garment, he wants you to rend your heart. That's what needs to be torn open, to open it up to God. Rend your heart and not your garments, and turn unto the Lord your God. That's the purpose of a fast. For he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger. Doesn't mean he doesn't get angry. The one thing God does not do, you know, which, you know, we seem to, you know, some of us, certain of us seem to have problems, and that is if we fly off the handle very rapidly. Now, God gets angry, I'll guarantee you, boy, he gets enraged. And you know, the Bible calls it his fierce anger. But it's never fast, and it's only because it's been provoked to the nth degree. But you know, we'll fly off the handle just like that, won't we? Too many times. You see, but God is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, of great kindness, and repents him of the evil. That is, he may change his mind on what's coming, depending on what your particular attitude would be. So you see, brethren, without those ingredients that go with fasting, it isn't really going to accomplish that much in your life. So here we are coming up now to the Day of Atonement. It's going to be the one commanded fast day. How are we going to approach it and how are we going to face it? Well, what I've told you today applies to the Day of Atonement, but it also applies to every other occasion where you deem it necessary to fast. Just remember, fasting is done for public calamity or threatened calamity, problems, personal problems, afflictions, sickness, illness, you know, all of these things that are and involve you personal in your life that are of the negative aspect. And then certainly as far as the ministry is concerned for ordinations. But without the confession and the humiliation and the humbling of the self and the acknowledgement of sin and guilt and the weeping and all that goes along with it in true repentance, it will be of little value. So brethren, there's what the Bible teaches on how to fast.